Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I first found out about Anne Pellegrini when I read her work, Love the Sin, Sexual Regulation and the Limits of Religious Tolerance, in which she argues in a book co-written with Janet Jacobson that the government regulation of family is in fact a violation of the separation of church and state, and is in fact a form of religious regulation in which the state should not be involved. She has just published a brand new book, which I received a copy of, called Secularisms, again co-edited with Janet Jacobson, just come out Duke University Press, which looks very exciting. She's a very well-known queer theorist, psychoanalytic theorist, performance theorist. She recently held I thought this was fantastic. I thought she'd made it up. She held the Freud Fulbright at Vienna. And so please join me in welcoming Anne Pellegrini.
I want to thank Roger and Stefania for all their work putting together this rich and richly stimulating conference from which I've already learned so much. And I'm truly honored to be part of it, though, and here's the confession part, I do worry that my last name lends me more credibility than I or this talk may deserve. And this is not simply because I'm probably as deracinated an Italian-American as you are likely to meet, but also because I'm speaking to you solo today, so much of what I want to talk to you about has been generated out of collaborative writing and thinking with my friend Janet Jacobson. In our co-written book, Love the Sin, Janet and I focus on the religious politics of sexuality, or perhaps it's the sexual politics of religion, in the United States, to ask why cherished American ideals of church-state separation and of freedom as highest good come crashing to the floor when it comes to sexual freedom. If freedom is such an important American value that the president is willing to send men and women off to fight and die in its name, then why isn't sexual freedom a mainstream American value too? Our short answer to this question is religion, but not religion in general, as if there were really any such thing. Rather, we were interested in laying out how specifically Protestant ideas about bodily life and good and bad sexual practices have profoundly shaped and constrained not just the possibilities of sexual freedom, but even, we argue, the realization of religious freedom as well. Nowhere is this religionized sexual regulation made more clear than in the range of federal and state laws and policies directed at homosexuality. When it comes to sex, even the Supreme Court, that body charged with enforcing church-state separation, as often seems to offer theology as it does justice. This was certainly the case in Bowers v. Hardwick, that infamous 1986 decision upholding the power of states to outlaw something called sodomy. In that decision, the court explicitly cited, quote, Judeo-Christian moral and ethical standards, close quote, as among its justifications. I'm going to bracket the host of problems that this impossible coupling, Judeo-Christian, attempts to suture. It's not the last time we'll hear this term today. Now, Janet and I wrote Love the Sin before the Supreme Court's 2003 decision in Lawrence and Garner v. Texas, which overturned bans on consensual homosexual sodomy. This was a landmark decision, to be sure, but it remains to be asked just how far this decision goes. We may be surprised by some of the possible answers. On the face of it, the debate over homosexuality has now moved on from sex and sodomy to the question of marriage, a movement utterly predicted in the reasoning of Lawrence, the majority decision's demurrals notwithstanding. Here is Justice Anthony Kennedy writing for the majority, and I'm quoting, "When sexuality finds overt expression in intimate conduct with another person, the conduct can be but one element in a personal bond that is more enduring. The liberty protected by the Constitution allows homosexual persons the right to make this choice. What kind of liberty is this, and what kind of choosing, when the choice is circumscribed to the home and to the couple form?" I'll come back to this. The marriage question hardly gets us out of the thick of debates about the place of religion in U.S. law and social policy. Despite the putative separation of church and state, one of the major places in the United States where religion and the state remain entwined is around sexuality, and specifically at the point of marriage, where religious officials are actually empowered to act on behalf of the state. Moreover, whenever politicians talk about marriage laws, they nearly always do so with reference to religious commitments, and the political affiliation or philosophy of the policymaker doesn't much matter in terms of this outcome. It's so nice to know that bipartisanship is alive and well in the United States, out of the frying pan and into the fire. But what I want to stress right now is the following. The solution to the problem that religion represents for sexual freedom in the United States is not secularism. Or if it is, it is not secularism as it has historically been institutionalized and practiced in the United States. Elsewhere, Janet and I call the version of secularism that holds sway in the United States Christian secularism. By this term, we mean to point to the fact that secularism, in its dominant and dominating form, remains tied to a particular religion, Christianity, and a particular history of origins in the Enlightenment. As we write in the introduction to our new anthology, Secularisms, secularism is central to the Enlightenment narrative in which reason progressively frees itself from the bonds of religion and so frees humanity. This familiar narrative aligns secularism with universalism, reason, progress, freedom, and peace, and counterposes religion as an irrational, atavistic force in the world whose dogmatism makes it an active obstacle to political change and to the forward movement of time itself. But what does it mean to this much-told tale and the correlations put forward by it? If we take seriously the co-implication of the secular and the religious, rather than their absolute distinction. For one thing, this suggests that we need to pluralize secularism and consider how secularism changes in relation to the specific national and religious contexts in which it operates. At the same time, though, it is not enough blithely to pluralize secularisms, to speak then of Hindu secularism, Jewish secularism, Muslim secularism, if we do not also take seriously how these particular secularisms are themselves formed in relation to, and in the shadow of, a dominant secularism whose history ties it to a particular time, place, and religion. This is what we mean by Christian secularism. How must we then think differently about the ways in which secularism itself can be a vehicle for imposing particular values rather than the universal values it asserts as its gift to humanity? In the United States, but not only here, Christian secularism is part of the very dynamic whereby issues of sexual morality are at one and the same time named personal or private and are also represented as key guarantors of the body public's health and well-being. If this is a Foucauldian biopolitics hallmark of the modern secular state, it is also a biopolitics that has never left religion behind, even when religious difference has come to be recoded in terms of national and/or racial difference. Discourses of sexuality have been crucial to this recoding. Did we need Abu Ghraib to tell us this? The freedoms instituted by the Protestant Reformation for the market and from the church also instituted a specific and specifically Protestant understanding of sexual ethics. Now, this is something that Janet has separately been pursuing in a new book that she's writing about freedom. And she's been looking at the implications of this shift in the Protestant sexual ethic. In an essay evocatively entitled Sex Plus Freedom Equals Regulation, Why? She's pretty good at titles, too. Janet argues that regulation, including sexual regulation, is internal to sexual freedom, secular freedom, not an imposition upon it. Now, this might seem a basic point after Foucault. But Janet's innovation is to mark the Protestant terms of the incitement to sexuality that has characterized modernity. Writing in and out of a French Catholic context, Foucault's history of sexuality tends to tell the story of transformations within Catholic treatment of sex in the confession and into secular sexuality as if they are the story of sex in the West without qualification. But historically attuned and religiously specific qualifications are needed if we are to make sense of the particular forms that sexual regulation as secular sexual freedom have taken in modernity. By focusing on the forms of freedom that emerged out of the Protestant Reformation, Janet shows us how sex provided a means of distinguishing the Protestant way of life from its Catholic forebears. She argues, and I'm going to quote her at some length here, "Protestant freedom is an incitement to sexuality over against the celibacy of priestly and monastic life, and an incitement specifically to matrimonial and reproductive sexuality. Clergy and those with religious vocations are now free to marry, but there are losses in this freedom. There is a loss of alternatives to marriage, a loss that has particular implications for how women might please themselves. As a number of feminist historians have noted, the Protestant destruction of monastic life meant an end to a major alternative to marriage for women. It is not that marriage is bad, that people, including women, in their freedom would never choose marriage, but that marriage becomes the only expression of sexual freedom. The choice between marriage and monastic celibacy is not necessarily a wide range of options, but monastic celibacy was an alternative way of life, one that allowed some women access to education and empowerment within the church." And I think there's a really interesting connection here to Ariana's talk earlier today. She points to the wide gap between a Catholic sexual ethic of in which the highest calling is the vocation of chastity, the religious vocation of chastity, and the norms on the ground, the ways in which people actually live their lives. What happens in the realignment of the Protestant Reformation is the following. The gap between norm in the sense of ideal and norm in the way of life is closed. Marriage as statistical norm becomes marriage as ideal, the norm as ideal. And this closing, right, this coming together actually produces some ongoing problems for us in terms of sexual ethics and the meaning of sexual freedom today. And this is why Janet can argue the following. Sexual regulation is not the antithesis of modern freedom. I want to repeat this. Sexual regulation is not the antithesis of modern freedom, but is constitutive of freedom as we know it. If this is the case, then not only is secularism not the answer to the blockages religion supposedly poses to sexual freedom, neither is freedom. At a time when the United States is busily and even forcibly exporting its version of freedom and democracy, this is not just an American problem. I'm now going to sort of move on to four parts that I hope will cohere. Part one, the religious right is dead, or careful what you wish for. Judging from recent news coverage, the religious right is, if not dead, then politically staggered and in retreat, to use the words of New York Times religion reporter Peter Steinfels. Evangelical skepticism about Senator John McCain has not prevented his successful run for the Republican presidential nomination. The moral issues that mobilized so-called values voters and supposedly turned the election for George W. Bush in 2004, abortion and gay marriage, do not seem to have traction this time around. A new crop of evangelical leaders, among them Rick Warren, author of the bestseller The Purpose-Driven Life, and Richard Cizik, vice president of the National Association of Evangelicals, is resurrecting a social gospel Christianity on the right, or at least right of center, and calling their flock to confront issues like global warming and poverty as Christians. And a final blow, the two remaining Democratic contenders have neutralized the God gap by speaking publicly about their own faith commitments. Well, let's not break out the bubbly just yet. For one thing, the very fact that Hillary Rodham Clinton and Barack Obama have been making such public professions of the Christian faith is already evidence of how successfully and with what long-term effects the Christian right has reshaped normative political discourse in this country. The Constitution may bar religious tests for public office, but that has not prevented the question of religious affiliation from arising on both sides of the political aisle. Just ask Mitt Romney, the first major Mormon candidate to run for president, who signally failed his Jack Kennedy moment. And another reason not to celebrate just yet is that John McCain may be playing nice right now, but come the general election, we should not expect him, or more likely, his various surrogates, many of them at a safely deniable distance, to resist injecting religionized issues of personal morality into public debate. If the Democratic nominee is Clinton, who comes loaded down not just with her own, but also her husband's moral baggage. Or we should not be surprised when they inject racialized issues of religious difference into the debate if the nominee is Obama. innuendo that Obama is a stealth Muslim and therefore an anti-Semite has been swirling on the internet for months, much of it centering on his middle name, Hussein. The term Manchurian candidate has come up in a lot of the media commentary about these rumors. And we really need to take seriously the race and religion baiting at work here. Obama's numerous proclamations of his Christianity have hardly dented the internet rumor mill. But the repetition of Barack Hussein Obama is not just the stuff of the internet smear campaigns. It has crossed over into the traditional media outlets, right-wing talk radio, and the opposition tactics of the Republican Party and of the Clinton campaign as well. But another reason obituaries for the religious right are premature is because, and to quote that modern-day philosopher Donald Rumsfeld, stuff happens. Events have a way of being more fluid than the narratives used to describe them. When David Kirkpatrick analyzed the evangelical crack-up, that's his term, the evangelical crack-up, I thought it was about stand-up comedy, who knew, and in October 2007 cover story in the New York Times Magazine, he based some of his confidence on the demise and breakup of the evangelical movement, on the fact that the candidate leading Republican polls nationwide was the thrice-married, I guess if you don't count one of the annulments, the thrice-married, socially liberal, loosely Catholic Rudy Giuliani. How times do change. And in his February 16th beliefs column, again in the New York Times, ominously entitled, quote, "Religious right may be fading, but not the culture wars," Peter Steinfels warned that the waning influence of the religious right did not mean that religious conflict over gay marriage, abortion rights, and stem cell research would go away anytime soon. I'm quoting Steinfels now. "Combat may wane, at least for a while, at least a little, but there are good reasons to doubt any lasting truce, let alone a real peace." Now, Steinfels goes on to specify the conditions under which simmering conflict might be stirred into renewed culture wars. How so, we might ask? If victorious, if victorious liberals and progressives in a Democratic administration take too many puffs at the bong of Christopher Hitchens and give vent to an anti-religious payback after 8 years in the political wilderness. Okay, the bong metaphor was mine, but it seemed a needed interruption of Steinfeld's martial rhetoric. And frankly, I don't know what Steinfeld's is smoking, but we should be so lucky to get not just a Democratic administration, but one in which the solidly centrist Clinton or solidly centrist Obama appoints a marauding horde of liberals and progressives. Inhale, people, but don't hold your breath. Now, I think Steinfeld's is right that we are not done with social conflict over issues that touch on sexual ethics. Just wait and watch the stuff fly in 90 days when the California State Supreme Court rules on gay marriage, or wait and watch again when Connecticut State Supreme Court rules sometime before the November elections. If I think he's right that we're not done with social conflict, I think his analysis is wrong. In fact, I think his reasoning is part of the problem and is bound up in his rhetoric, which is at once commonplace and extraordinary. Commonplace because of the frequency with which debates and differences over sexual values are so quickly renamed culture war. But extraordinary and worth attending to because the language of culture war does not neutrally describe a state of affairs that actually exists in the world. Instead, it participates in and actively reinforces a grid of cultural intelligibility that habitually reduces and sorts complex relations and complex differences into two opposed sides. Further, in this particular instance, Steinfeld's choice of wording dangerously promotes an almost inevitable and timeless conflict between, quote, religion and, quote, secularism. I'm putting these terms in quotes because I think we really need to put pressure on the notion that these are homogeneous units, right? His choice of wording dangerously promotes an almost inevitable and timeless conflict between religion and secularism, with these positions parceled out to, respectively, the right and the left, Republicans and liberal Democrats. Now, this is not about individual intentionality, as in bad Peter Steinfels, bad. Rather, with Foucault, we need to think about how discursive frames intentionalize through the repetition and through the unpredictable assemblages to which they give rise. In the American context, one of the unintended but absolutely empowered effects of this way of narrating political differences as a polarized conflict between two sides and two sides only, is to generate the fiction of a neutral, moral middle able to adjudicate and settle the difference. This triangular structure is embedded in liberalism's longstanding equality difference problem, and it so often leads to a hierarchical relationship between a dominant center and its two opposed poles of difference. Another relationship for this hierarchy of difference is tolerance. To invoke tolerance is to invoke a specific religious history. As Janet and I argue in Love the Sin, conceptions of religious tolerance, or toleration, were developed in Europe in response to the wars of religion that were sparked by the Protestant Reformation. European Christianity was no longer dominated by one holy Catholic and apostolic church, but by several different religions laying claim, sometimes violently, to the title of true religion. Most conventional histories of the Reformation and its aftermath understand the wars of religion to have been resolved through the development of religious tolerance. But this tolerance, from its inception, was quite limited. For example, in England, the established church was and remains a Protestant church, the Church of England. The Toleration Act of 1689 removed certain legal penalties against those Protestants who dissented from the Church of England, and it ended the requirement that all British subjects subscribe to the Articles of Faith of the Church of England. Crucially, however, the Act did not protect non-Protestant dissenters from persecution. Catholics and Jews, Muslims and atheists were all outside the bounds of official tolerance. Although the boundaries of toleration have been expanded over time, the Church of England remains the established and official faith of England. Part two, speaking freedom while teaching tolerance. American principles of religious freedom were supposed to overcome these limits of toleration. In principle, religious freedom provides for the equal treatment of different faiths. There is no established church, that's the first part of the religion clause in the First Amendment, and all religions are free to practice as they please. This component of free exercise also does include the freedom to practice no religion at all. The First Amendment, okay, it's disestablishment and free exercise. These are the two crucial components of First Amendment religious freedom. But this ideal of religious freedom has never really been enacted in the United States. In fact, as Janet likes to quip, in the United States, under conditions of Protestant dominance, what religious freedom actually means is the freedom to act Protestant even when you're not. Now, this is a great line, but it also makes a very sober point, namely that because of the ways in which specifically Protestant ideas have been embodied in secular law, we actually have a situation in the United States much more akin to the situation of Britain with an established church than we do have to the proclamation of religious freedom that is embedded in the U.S. Constitution. Right. Now, it may be that the limitations of tolerance in the United States are exacerbated by what is essentially a two-party political system. This is something I'd be happy to discuss with you during the discussion period. And the virtual monopoly the two parties have on electoral politics means that American democracy is constantly held hostage by what feminist law professor Nan Hunter has termed the lunatic center. There are basically two very different ways of conceiving the meaning and procedures of American democracy. The first is majority rules. The second, freedom and equality for minorities. We heard this confusion last week between these two notions, majority rules and freedom and equality for minorities. We heard this confusion last week when the California State Supreme Court heard arguments about whether the state may permissibly ban gay marriage. Opponents of gay marriage asserted that this question was best left to voters, not to judges. Read here, activist judges. You know, a judge is only an activist when you don't like his or her decision. When you agree with the decision, it's just justice. Glenn Levy, who defended the ban for the Alliance Defense Fund, promised to take the cause directly to the voters if the court had the effrontery to allow same-sex marriage. What the court is being asked to do, he said, is shortchange the democratic process. Now, of course, so much depends here on what your conception of democratic procedures is. During the oral arguments, though, some members of the court even wondered aloud if it was their role to make this decision. Once again, showing that just because you're empowered to enforce the Constitution doesn't mean you've read it. Now, this conflict in these two different models of American democracy is related to another one, namely a conflict in U.S. self-understanding to do with religion and religious identity. The conflict is this. We are basically a Christian nation, and we are a nation of religious freedom. This tension, about the place of religious identity, and this other tension about what democratic procedure means. How do we resolve these two tensions? Now, the most common way to resolve these two tensions, historically, has been by appeal to tolerance. But for whom exactly is this a happy resolution? To be sure, tolerance may be better than overt violence against minorities, but the social space it opens for difference still remains very narrow. In practice, tolerance basically means that those who are different from sometimes stated, sometimes implicit dominant norms, are admitted into or near the charm circle on the condition that they give up, or at least cover up, the forms of life that make them different from the center. In this way, a dominant majority gets to have it both ways, extending its dominance even as it can remain sincerely convinced of its own beneficence. Currently, California has a domestic partnership law that extends to gay and lesbian couples many but scarcely all of the rights and benefits they would receive if they had full marriage rights. Now, to some, this might seem like a solid compromise, a good and reasonable middle way between extremists on both sides, those who want gay marriage and will settle for nothing less, and those who are irrevocably opposed to gay marriage and even to civil unions. But we need to think about the way this compromise works and for whom. As Janet and I argue, many political moderates and liberals, too, are uncomfortable with gay marriage. But they are also uncomfortable with the idea of appearing intolerant of their gay friends and neighbors. The fact of the matter is that on the gay marriage question, as around many other divisive social and cultural issues in American life, and especially those that have to do with sex, people of goodwill can take positions, let's call them compromising positions, that are punitive towards their fellow citizens, while at the same time experiencing themselves as basically good people, morally glamorous people, in the words of Kathleen Roberts Skerritt, who are compassionate and even tolerant of difference. Professions of tolerance mixed with stern moral judgment are a routine feature of political life in the United States. When President Bush came out in favor of a federal constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, a move which would create a permanent constitutional underclass, he concluded his remarks with a call for, quote, kindness and goodwill and decency. Thanks. But what of those who are the objects of this finely measured tolerance? I'd like to think that most gay people would prefer justice and democracy to the personal kindness and goodwill and decency of the friendly homophobe next door or on Pennsylvania Avenue. Nonetheless, such is the thrall of tolerance that it remains very difficult to conceive sexual freedom as a public and fully social value. Teach tolerance. Teach tolerance. It's more than a ubiquitous bumper sticker and T-shirt slogan. It organizes public feelings, public policies, and educational efforts to counter violence and prejudice. The Southern Poverty Law Center encourages us to teach tolerance, and the Simon Wiesenthal Center's efforts to teach young people about the Holocaust is focused around a museum of tolerance. I want to stay with the issue of teaching tolerance for a while longer, turning to a recent and controversial proposal to instruct young people in the lessons of the Holocaust, Part 3, French Lessons. Earlier, we heard Claudia discuss the ongoing role of the Catholic Church in Italian politics. With its strict enforcement of church-state separation, French laicism would seem to offer a diametrically opposite view. In practice, though, and here I think I would probably disagree a little bit with Claudia, the French case, too, shows how specifically religious claims and ideals can survive in the guise of égalité. And I also think that the French example is going to show us a particularly stark and vivid example of liberal tolerance at work. We see this in the recent proposal by French President Nicolas Sarkozy to introduce a new Holocaust pedagogy into all fifth-grade classrooms. His proposal pivots on the figure of the child, which serves as a crossing point and a crisis between the bio and the necro, between, that is, life and death. Because the stakes of this crossing are so urgent, I hope you will indulge me this momentary stopover in France. We'll be back in America soon enough. In a February 13th speech to members of France's Jewish community, Sarkozy announced a new educational initiative. Beginning next year, each French fifth grader would be assigned the life story of an individual French child victim of the Holocaust. The one-to-one match was explicitly framed as a project of overcoming difference. Here's how Sarkozy put the matter. Nothing is more moving for a child than the story of a child his own age who has the same games, the same joys, and the same hopes as he, but who in the dawn of the 1940s had the bad fortune to be defined as a Jew. There's so much to say here. Note how Sarkozy's invocation of luck, the bad fortune to be defined as a Jew, oops, evacuates the agency of both perpetrators and collaborators. But the bad fortune of being defined by one's identity, which is to say by one's difference, from what though? From Frenchness, from the universal human, from Frenchness as the universal human, the bad fortune of being defined by one's identity does link up with some of Sarkozy's stress throughout on achieving sameness, the same games, the same joys, and the same hopes. His proposal created a storm of opposition and has subsequently been modified. Instead of matching each French fifth grader with an individual child victim of the Holocaust, each French fifth grade class will share a dead Jewish child. This adjustment seems to have been made in response to criticism, such as that voiced by Simone Veil, a French Holocaust survivor, that the weight of an identification with a dead child would be too heavy, too traumatizing for the school child to bear. Hence the move to share this burden of identification amongst an entire class of students. But in either case, the lamination of pedagogy and necrophilia is astonishing. Is this, then, what remains of Auschwitz, a reliquary for French pedagogy? And yet there is a certain logic at work here that takes us and takes us ever again in the place of a never again, that takes us to the place where biopolitics and necropolitics meet. In a work in progress, Gil Anajar draws on Lee Edelman's argument in No Future, Queer Theory and the Death Drive, and Elias Canetti's Crowds and Power, to suggestively link two modern figures and two modern discourses of futurity, the child and the survivor. If we are, as Edelman argues, unable to conceive of politics without a fantasy of futurity, the figure of the child steps in to secure that fantasy for us. This is a fantasy with real-world consequences via the regulation of sexual life and reproduction. And Anajar pushes us to see how the figure of the survivor also involves fantasies of and imperatives for reproduction as a response to the interruption of generation caused by genocide. In the end, Anajar concludes, these two figures, the child and the survivor, share the fundamental presupposition of modern politics, and with Foucault I want to say here, modern biopolitics, namely that the body politic must survive. Of course, the bloody history of the 20th and now 21st centuries teaches us that the survival of some too often requires the coordinated and wide-scale death of some others. In Terrorist Assemblages, Homo Nationalism in Queer Times, Jaspier Poir powerfully draws together the work of Michel Foucault on biopolitics and Achille Mbembe on necropolitics to illuminate those, these are Poir's words, to illuminate those interstices between life and death, those interstices within which some queer subjects are being folded back into the project of the neoliberal state and its reproduction, while forms of racialized queerness allow for the exclusion even unto death of some other queer bodies. I mean, Roger spoke at the beginning today of the demonization of homosexuals and homosexuality. I think that's true. But one of the things that Poir is pushing us to do is to realize that this demonization of some queer bodies is happening at the same time as some other queer bodies are actually being invited into the charm circle of the neoliberal state. And racialization becomes crucial to thinking about the demonization of some, the inclusion of some others. This relay between inclusion and exclusion marks a point of oscillation between the individuating disciplines of the subject and the massifying technologies of population. I'll return a bit later to the role that U.S. sexual exceptionalism, this is Poir's term, plays in the global reproduction of relations of living and dying, plotting it in relation to something I've come to call sexualism. For now, though, let me go back to school with President or Principal Nicolas Sarkozy. Because Sarkozy's proposal was animated by religious language, he blamed the genocidal violence of the 20th century on, quote, an absence of God, and called Nazi racism, quote, radically incompatible with Judeo-Christian monotheism. Because of this religious framing, much of the criticism of his plan took the form of accusing him of violating sacrosanct French ideals of church-state separation and the privatization of religious difference. Others worried that the focus on victims would focus attention away from Vichy France's collaboration with genocidal violence against Jews. Again, we hear the language of the bad fortune to be defined as a Jew. Finally, there were worries that the Holocaust curriculum would create resentment among France's ethnic Arab and North African populations, as the New York Times delicately put it. These worries are all related, of course, even if their overlap was not remarked upon in the U.S. media. The return of the repressed here, or one of them at least, is an earlier French school reform involving the ban on conspicuous religious symbols, and as well as conspicuous religious dress in public schools, and Claudia mentioned this earlier as well. Despite the neutral wording of the French law, we all know that it was centrally aimed at the Muslim headscarf, though its secondary casualties have included the Jewish kippah and the Sikh turban. Conspicuous signs of Christian identity do come within the imagined reach of the law, but one wonders just how big the sign of the cross would have to be to occasion censure. Promoted in the cause of French universalism, the law thereby installs a particular French body as the universal body. The particular French body of French Christian secularism at once tucks its religious difference out of sight and projects it as the blank slate of French secularism. Against this background, Sarkozy's assertion that racial hierarchy is radically incompatible with Judeo-Christian monotheism resounds with the Abrahamic monotheism he did not name, Islam. This is not an innocent omission. It silently insinuates that Islam is all too compatible with racist violence and transfers the historical burden of French antisemitism to sources outside French civilization. So when French antisemitism does come home, it comes home in the person of those foreign strains within the French body politic, racialized Muslims, citizen strangers. It is they who stand accused in the present of threatening French Jews with annihilation. But the survival of French Jews is ultimately less the point of this Holocaust pedagogy than is the survival and reproduction of a universal French culture. This is where the figure of the child becomes a strange sort of hinge. Living French children are called to identify with dead Jewish child victims. This identification produces a third child, let's call it the virtual child, the child yet to be. This virtual child figures a future in which difference has been left behind. There is something disturbingly Hegelian in this overcoming of the dead child on the way to becoming a modern subject of and in history. But there is also something Pauline about a French version of universalism in which there is no Christian and no Jew. And finally, there is something of the Christ child in this figure who rises from the ashes of so many dead Jews. Those who cannot or will not pass through this door risk a different kind of passage, from human being into the zone of bare, unassignable life. Another name, another figure arises here, Der Musulman, literally, the Muslim. In Remnants of Auschwitz, Giorgio Agamben notes the ferocious irony known to Jews at Auschwitz. They knew they would not die as Jews, but as Musulman, as Muslim. A fresh and no less ferocious irony, then, appears at the prospect of French Muslim children being asked to identify with dead Jewish ones, being asked, that is, to identify with Der Musulman. If I belabor, and I'm not done yet, the French example, it's because it shows how the survival of the body politic happens not by keeping death at bay, but by soliciting it. As sight of the solicitation, the child uneasily straddles past and future, death and life. Lee Edelman may be right that the child summons the fantasy of a future, but we must critically supplement his analysis by asking which child, whose fantasized future? If we move from figural children to concrete children, and we must do so, if we are to illuminate the blank spots, the whiteness of Edelman's analysis, we see that the Muslim children are not figures securing a fantasy of reproductive futurism, that's Edelman's terms, they're not figuring a fantasy of reproductive futurism for themselves, but for others. And it's a fantasy that mandates their identification with their own erasure. By way of concluding, I want to return to American controversies over same-sex marriage and the place of the child in these debates. So part four, what about the children? When push comes to shove, opponents of same-sex marriage basically have two answers for why marriage needs to be protected from same-sex couples. The first answer is religion. The second culturally powerful objection takes the form of a question, what about the children? And we heard from Claudia, this is also the question being posed in the Italian context. The worry is not simply the facetious assertion that homosexuals do not have children and so might bring about a cataclysmic depopulation of the planet, for this is not about literal reproduction. The more intensive concern is that homosexuals cannot reproduce the right relations to gender roles, to family, to nation, to the moral order of things, and even, I'd argue, to the demands of linear time. Homosexuals are throwbacks. In this way, in some sense, homosexuals are atavistic, like religion is imagined to be by secularism. This worry, what about the children, is not the preoccupation only of opponents of gay marriage. For when it comes to marriage, both sides, those who are for it and those who are against it, make many of the same arguments. Marriage offers the stability and security necessary for forming and maintaining the bonds of family, especially when there are children involved. The boiled-down version, it's about the children, stupid. Fascinatingly, in a series of court decisions handed down in the wake of Lawrence v. Texas, protecting children and optimizing the conditions in which they grow up have been given as legal justifications for rulings advancing marriage rights for gay men and lesbians and for rulings blocking them. So, for example, when the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court found in favor of same-sex marriage in 2003, it did so in part because it saw bringing gay men and lesbians within the fold of marriage as a way of, to quote the majority decision, encouraging stable adult relationships for the good of the individual and of the community, especially its children. Compare this to the 2006 decisions in New York and Washington State, where courts used precisely the same rhetoric, the need to provide stable home lives for children, but came to precisely opposite conclusions. The New York State decision is especially hilarious in its finding that the state legislature could rationally decide to limit marriage to opposite-sex couples because same-sex couples, quote, do not become pregnant by accident or impulse, as is the case with too many heterosexual couples. The latter, these heterosexual couples who become pregnant by accident or impulse or are liable to do so, the latter are accordingly more in need of the forms of stability than marriage provides, argued the court. Basically, I mean, this is my version of what the court was saying. Basically, heterosexuals have bad impulse control and need special benefits to keep themselves in check. The New York court also found that the state legislature could rationally believe that, quote, it is better, other things being equal, for children to grow up with both a mother and a father. Intuition and experience suggest that a child benefits from having before his or her eyes every day living models of what both a man and a woman are like, close quote. Now, given the court's earlier emphasis on the bad impulse controls of heterosexual couples, one wonders just what these man-woman unions are living models of, but I leave that to your imagination. The oral arguments before the California State Supreme Court last week also centrally orbited around children and what family forms are best for their successful development. Again, this is not about literal reproduction, the outrageous preoccupations of New York State's highest court aside. Invocations of and worries over the child are doing many things in debates over same-sex marriage, but one of them is to re-suture very narrow terms of biopolitical reproduction in order to provide a foil for necropolitical violence. That is, in order to provide a foil behind which we will not see the violences being done in our name, in the name of perpetuating a regeneration, regenerating the nation. The Lawrence decision marked an early moment in which some gay and lesbian Americans were sutured to the project of national regeneration in the form of the properly privatized couple. The promise of gay marriage is another performative occasion for saying we do, we will do for the nation and its ongoing renewal. I know I risk polemicism here, but it's a risk I think we can and must take. For it is vital to take stock of a larger global context within which a so-called cultural war over gay marriage in the United States is taking place, namely the war on terrorism, a war being prosecuted at home and abroad through massive killing, organized disappearances, unlawful detention, and state-licensed torture, all in the name of defending our freedom. Earlier, I made reference to Jaspeer Poir's identification and analysis of something she calls U.S. sexual exceptionalism. In Terrorist Assemblages, Poir moves to expose the bargain whereby some queers, not all or even most queers, she emphasizes, are recognized by the nation as good citizens, as patriots even. One especially powerful and persuasive example of this production of gay and queer bodies as fit subjects for patriotic inclusion has occurred in the wake of the torture of Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib. Media accounts of the torture at Abu Ghraib focused on the sexual aspects of the torture, obsessing over the simulation of gay sex, and secondly, the deliberate targeting of Muslims, something called Muslim sensitivities, around sexuality, the body, and a supposedly tabooed homosexuality. Right? One of the things that Poir does is point to the profound and historically recordable Orientalism at work in this depiction of Muslim sensitivities. According to this line of reasoning, the sexual torture works so well because sexuality in general and homosexuality in particular are repressed in the Muslim world. Discourses of sexual freedom, ours, and discourses of sexual oppression, it's theirs, and the circuits of power knowledge that course through both of them thus empowered an astonishing reversal, whereby the racist, misogynist, and homophobic violence performed by U.S. soldiers against Iraqi bodies reemerges as a response to the pre-existing homophobia and masculinism of a totalized Muslim culture. Our violence reemerges then as proof of U.S. sexual exceptionalism, U.S. tolerance, and even the value of our freedom. This way of representing what happened at Abu Ghraib also reinforces a picture of Islam itself as repressive. And it is a short leap from here to seeing Islam as threatening the values of Western civilization tout court. These values are the values of secularism. But because of the historical dominance of Christian secularism, these are also Christian values. So we are here now at a very strange juncture. If, as my friend Janet has argued, at an earlier moment, sex helped to articulate differences between Protestant and Catholic forms of life, today, with both Jasper Poir and Janet, we can see how a secular sexual freedom actually works to distinguish between secular modernity and regressive Islam, and works as well to delineate a space between life and bare life. One of the animating questions of Love the Sin is why the high value set on freedom in the United States comes crashing to the floor when it comes to sex. Abu Ghraib shows us what happens when a particular version of sexual freedom, that's what I'm calling sexularism, when a particular version of sexual freedom does get taken up as a mainstream American value. For domestic subjects of sexual freedom, freedom is a matter of internal self-regulation. For the targets of American-style freedom, targets in the sense of imagined beneficiaries, and targets too in the sense of threatening obstacles to the bestowal of this gift of freedom to others, for those targets, freedom is violently imposed from without. But in neither instance is this the freedom Janet and I move to argue for in our book. But it is, I think, the freedom ultimately on offer in Lawrence v. Texas, and it is the freedom coming soon to a justice of the peace near you, goodbye, perverse adult, hello, Malthusian couple, and baby makes three. Thank you.
Do you feel that the American and perhaps British peace movement is pulling its punches because a lot of people that are active feel that Islam is essentially regressive, anti-feminist, and anti-gay?
I don't know that I suppose we might want to think of peace movements plural. I do think that secular peace activists might find themselves in a particular quandary because of the imagination that secularism is somehow the answer to religious dogmatism. Religious dogmatism identified abroad as with jihad and Islamic fundamentalism. A religious dogmatism identified at home with evangelical fundamentalisms and conservative Catholicism as well. But I think that seeing religion as the obstacle, right, and posing secularism as the solution is actually a misrecognition of the history of violence of the 20th century. Right. I've really been the beneficiary of doing so much co-writing with Janet. But Janet has the title, again, a great title of an essay called "Is Secularism Less Violent Than the Religious?" And what she ultimately comes to argue is, well, actually, kind of no. Right. We can't. You know, it's often thought, well, secularism is the solution to religious violence. But because if secularism embeds within it a form of cultural dominance, because of its particular history out of Christian enlightenment. The secularism that exposes itself as universal and as the bestower of freedom and universal reason can actually be experienced by those to whom we give it, here you go, as a form of cultural imperialism. So I think that this bind, I think that for many sort of, it might well be that for many peace activists, and not just peace activists, for many secularists, because of and partly to do with the history of secularism itself, they can't even see some of the religious dominations embedded within secularism, which makes it hard to think more supply about religion. Moreover, there's this I think there's a deep historical amnesia in the United States in particular, and also in Britain. There's a distinguished history of religious activism of the left, whether in the movement for abolition of slavery in the United States and Britain. Think of the Quaker social justice movement. Think of the deep history of Catholic-based communities in Latin America. Think of Jewish secularism, which has a very interesting relationship to religious Judaisms. But this history, and you know, the Black civil rights movement is unimaginable outside of Black Protestantism. But that history is forgotten in the present moment, when religion seems to be posed as the enemy of modernity. But modernity is precisely constructed through the supposed opposition between religion and secularism. They're co-invented in modernity. In some sense, they are co-invented as modernity.
Some secularists feel that they're imposing, you know, they want to liberate people, but it's experienced as an imposition, almost an imperialistic imposition in some places. The divide may be currently being exposed, or maybe not exposed, but certainly seen there on the American left or in the American political body in general of sort of secular, not even secular liberals, but liberals sort of wanting to speak for lower class voters, yet on these issues, especially issues of sexuality, lower class, or I guess the new term is downscale Democrats, or whatever the phrase of the day is, don't necessarily share, either because of religious reasons, or, I mean, we could look at economic reasons why people who have lower incomes might be less friendly towards things like divorce, or want to have a stronger nuclear family, mm-hmm. and so how do you see the relationships there between economics, class, and this sort of divide where liberals want to speak for the downtrodden or the minority groups, and yet the minority groups often don't necessarily share the same values, or they might share the same economic values, but not the same social values. What do you see there in terms of what's going on?
No, I think that's a really useful question. I think this is where we have had such a balkanization of issues in American political life. A tendency to think, well, we've got the cultural issues, marriage, you know, whether gay marriage or divorce rate, abortion, and then we have the economic issues, like the hard bread and butter issues. Actually, they're fundamentally related, because the economic pressures on the family, I mean, it is not possible in a way that it was post-World War II, in the American economy post-World War II. It is no longer possible, except in very rare instances, for there to be a single breadwinner in a two-parent household. And there's been an extraordinary confluence in this between the inability, you know, basically the need for both breadwinners, if there are two people, to go out and work not just one job, but multiple jobs. Right? There's a confluence between that and another shift in which, in fact, feminism says, look, it's actually okay for women to go into previously all-male terrain. White middle-class women can do this now. Women of color have been doing it for a long time. White working-class women doing it for a long time. And there's something really extraordinary about this coincidence. Now, it's a coincidence. It's not causal. But the coincidence became a causal accusation. Feminism is among the things that knock the legs out from under the nuclear family with the male head of household. Without feminism and the gender realignments that feminism helped to occasion, this wouldn't have happened. But of course, some of these gender realignments also happened specifically in relationship to economic restructuring. So we need to talk about the anxieties and crises of the family precisely in relation to questions of economy, including globalization. And this also, we also then need to bring in debates over gay marriage. When people talk sincerely, these people are not stupid. When they sincerely talk about their feeling that gay marriage is a threat to their marriage and to family, they are speaking about this more general anxiety about the ways in which family no longer seems like the safe place it was supposed to be. Now, many women who've been abused by their male partners, many children who've been the victims of familial violence, know that family was never that safe place, but let's set that aside. The ideology of family has started to crumble, has started in its experience to crumble, even as the ideology remains. Right? So we need to think across these issues, not to say that debates about family and homosexuality are really about the economy. They're just epiphenomena of economic crises, because it is still more subtle, because you can have a situation, this is where Tom Frank has got it wrong, Thomas Frank's book, What Is It About Kansas? What's Wrong with Kansas? He can't understand why people in Kansas who stand in for this middle who've been duped, they've been duped by, you know, the fiscal conservatives to vote against their own economic self-interests. What he doesn't understand is that for many people, their economic self-interests are not their highest self-interests, right? This is why we can't just make economics the only story, but we do need to lace them together to tell a much more complex one. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.